to me, it seems totally insane and illogical to say that bombs bring peace, because they don't bring peace. They don't make the world a safer place.
We ask people of conscience to refuse to pay the federal excise tax on their phone bills.
I think the average American needs to know a little bit more history.
As a clear signal to our government that continuing the cycle of violence is wrong.
Who made Saddam Hussein? Who militarized him?
Peace is based on trust, and it leads to love. War is nourished by hatred, and it leads to death.
Back, which the U.S. is trying to block.
They don't let them into the palace. You notice that his people live in relative, have harsh sanctions, but he has 12 palaces that are...
Fine, then go in and look at the palaces.
Thanks to the great Iraqi people for the contributions that they have made to humanity since Babylon.
The chorus of voices of dissent is growing. This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. With full backing from the U.S. Congress to wage war against Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, the next major battleground for the Bush administration is the less certain terrain of the United Nations. The five permanent members of the U.N. Security Council will vote for a resolution outlining the terms of the weapons inspections under which Saddam Hussein must adhere to remain within the bounds of international law. Hans von Spanik is the former Assistant Secretary General of the U.N. who resigned out of protest over sanctions against Iraq. He's residing in Geneva, where we spoke with him about the most recent U.N. actions.
I'm a little bit more hopeful that a more reasonable resolution will emerge rather than the one that was proposed by the U.S. government, which was really unimplementable.
In what way?
In what way? It called for compliance of Iraq in areas that were simply not possible. For example, that a UN, and at times the press talks about a U.S., but I think that's an error. They meant a UN force, military force, should accompany inspectors in Iraq, including, U.S. military. Interviewing taking place outside of the country, including families, that's an encouragement to become refugees. A very tight deadline before everything had to be on the table in terms of declarations on the arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. Hardly the kind of approach that is constructive and would encourage the Iraqis to do everything they can. And they know it is a last card they have in their hand, so they will be much more willing now to cooperate, but not with a resolution of the kind that Washington had in mind.
Mm. Well, on one of the news programs this weekend, Mr. Powell, Colin Powell, put it this way: either Iraq cooperates and we get this disarmament done through peaceful means, or they do not cooperate and we will use other means to get the job done. And of course, the administration has plans to move ahead unilaterally, even without UN backing, if Saddam fails to comply.
Yeah, but you see, this is the whole problem. There is a hidden agenda here. And the hidden agenda is, in two words, regime change. And what the international community, and particularly the Europeans now, and I guess many American community groups also want to see, is a return of the UN inspectors as quickly as possible. The French proposals in the UN Security Council aim in that direction. And then we must try and make sure that all sides, the Iraqis as well as the U.S. and the U.K. and the U.N. Security Council as a whole, do everything in their in their might to avoid provocation, so that they can finally start the business of looking at Iraq's weapon of mass destruction situation and end this terrible, nauseating period of speculation. I think that's what the moment calls for, and this is what I think the public and many sober governments in Europe want to see.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of focus is now going to rest on what France will do and its role in the UN Security Council. Given your experience with the UN, do you know the ambassador from France to the UN, and what direction is he likely to go in?
Well, I think Ambassador Levitt and his predecessor, Ambassador Desjardins, both known to me, are very serious diplomats, and I think I would expect that they fulfill to the last letter the position that has been taken by President Chirac, who wants to make sure that there is absolutely no chance for automaticity, which would allow a government that has premeditated its a decision to attack to do so in the name of the United Nations and the United Nations Security Council. I have confidence that they will stick to that and that they will be backed up by most of the members of the UN Security Council, including the non-permanent 10 who are very anxious to play a role in this discussion, and they feel, as you have maybe heard when there was this public debate and earlier, very, very much left out, that they didn't have the voice that they feel the issue wants. And so I'm hopeful that certainly as far as the UN Security Council is concerned, things are going to give peace that chance which we all so much want the Security Council to support.
But what about Russia and China as the other two permanent members in the UN Security Council? Do you think they're inclined to give peace a chance as well?
I would say, despite of what one reads about the economic interests of Russia and the fact that China is always taking a wait-and-see attitude, I think both governments have repeatedly shown, to be fair with them, a real concern that the region isn't set aflame beyond what we see every day, including this very day again in Palestine, Israel, aflame. And they don't want this. And I think that is out of a very, very deep concern that a war of the kind that the administration of President Bush wants to have will create havoc, will deepen the crisis, and will make that war on terrorism so much more difficult. Mm.
Well, the United States says Iraq has these biological and chemical weapons and could be close to making nuclear arms, and Bush justifies his plan to attack by citing instances when Saddam Hussein used these weapons. As someone who has operated in the world community through the UN, how much of a threat does Iraq pose to world peace in Europe?
Well, you know, I certainly, first of all, I'm not a disarmament expert, but I have something to say on this. I have read all three documents, which the British government, the U.S. government, and the International Institute for Strategic Studies submitted to the public. I also happen to have visited two sites in July in Iraq, my choice, not forced upon me by the Iraqi government, with the German television. And those two sites very clearly showed that neither Aldora, a vaccine plant, nor a brake oil facility, Al-Fallujah, were in a state where they could do harm to anybody. They were destroyed. Now, in these three documents that were put forward by the U.S. and the British, it identifies these sites as having restarted production. Now, sure, if that's the basis on which evidence is offered, I'm afraid then there is even less to fear. And in any case, as now is admitted freely by analysts and by a good number of government spokespersons, the imminence of threat that is portrayed by the Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and his deputy and the President of the U.S. himself is absolutely not visible. And this is why you have so much resistance now around the world. And the best evidence of that resistance was what representatives from U.N. member governments who are not at the moment in the U.N. Security Council had to say when they were given an opportunity last week to speak on this issue. So I think that should lead the government in Washington to realize in what tremendous isolation they are at the moment with regard to this portrayal of Iraq as a state that emanates an immense threat that is so serious that we can't wait any longer.
How, in your opinion, Mr. Hans von Sponeck, would such a move on the part of the U.S., in other words, attacking Iraq because it fails to comply with the resolution or with the terms set up by the U.N. Security Council, how would such a move affect the credibility of the U.N. in the eyes of the world community?
From the U.S. angle, if the U.N. doesn't cooperate, it will go down the road of the League of Nations. It will go out of business, becomes irrelevant. Well, similarly, the international community would feel if the U.S. would attack Iraq without having gone through the United Nations Security Council, then this would be a very big nail in the coffin of the United Nations indeed, because the U.N. would then have to admit that even though it cautioned against a totally unjustified attack against Iraq, the U.S. didn't heed that advice, went ahead, did it. I think this is a lose-lose proposition, not a win-win one at all.
You were the Assistant Secretary General and you resigned for political reasons around Iraq. Can you remind us specifically about your reasons for resigning?
Well, at the time, it was a question of protesting against sanctions, economic sanctions, which after then almost 10 years had really punished the wrong party. The Iraqi people, the civilians, people who had nothing to do with this political conflict, were day after day pulled down further into misery, into death, with mortality rates that are higher than any other country around the world, according to UNICEF, and to be in charge of the largest UN humanitarian program the UN ever had. Would, if I had continued in that function, would have made me liable to be part of the wrongdoing, and I wasn't about to do that.
President Bush and the Bush administration have articulated as part of their agenda in Iraq regime change, citing that Saddam Hussein is a threat to his own people. You've been there. You lived, or you served as the former UN humanitarian coordinator for Iraq. What is the bigger threat to the Iraqi people?
Well, the Iraq reality cannot be, even though all sides try to do that, be explained in terms of a black and white picture. It is not clear this party is at fault and the other one is innocent. In the case of Iraq, of course, a dictator, a repressive dictator has contributed to suffering in that country. But for many years, whether those in the U.S. and British administrations want to hear it or not, for many years now, the red line between what can be considered as collateral damage, a necessary side effect, if you want, of economic sanctions, and the violation of international law, of just about all the conventions that have been created with U.S. government support. So when President Bush on the 12th of September came before the U.N. General Assembly and he cited that Iraq had violated 16 UN resolutions. That is unfortunate, and Iraq shouldn't do that, and he had a right to refer to it. But if his speech had been a balanced, a fair speech, he would have then reminded the international community of how many conventions and legal treaties the international community, under the leadership, I'm sorry, of the U.S. government, has violated in the case of Iraq. Nothing to say, and to let's be fair here also in the context of the Middle East, nothing is said about the number of U.N. resolutions Israel is violating without ever being held accountable by the powers of the day. The bigger threat for the people of Iraq, and that's my concern, that's why I get involved, for the people of Iraq at the moment is the continuation of a regime of sanctions which punish them and keep the person who is supposedly the target, Saddam Hussein and his government, firmly in place.
Hans von Sponeck, former UN Assistant Secretary General. Efforts to wage war in Iraq is sometimes justified by the administration with a variety of reasons. One which sometimes comes up relates to the bombing campaign the U.S. recently conducted in Afghanistan to remove the Taliban and install a new government, seen by the Bush administration as a successful war. This past Saturday in New York City, women gathered at the second annual conference organized by Women for Afghan Women to focus on what is happening in post-Taliban Afghanistan. And as Deepa Fernandez from Pacifica Station WBAI reports, the conference consistently touched on the parallels between the war in Afghanistan and a possible war against Iraq, with the general consensus that bombing does not bring peace.
The situation in Afghanistan and Pakistan is extremely dangerous and very, very unstable. So this idea that we've gone and we've cleaned up the mess is totally incorrect. I mean, the Taliban have been dislodged. Al-Qaeda has the center, you know, the central command has been disrupted. But they're now everywhere. I have been to Pakistan 3 times since last December. I was there in December. I was there in June. I was there in August. The situation seems to be getting worse and worse, in terms of just the dangers that ordinary people are subjected to, you know, in terms of terrorism, et cetera. I think that the U.S. has a lot of serious work to do in these countries first. The question of Iraq is, I think that it seems totally insane and illogical to say that bombs bring peace, because they don't bring peace. They don't make the world a safer place. So, you know, I think the average American needs to know a little bit more history as to how all these things started, and then who made Saddam Hussein what he is, who militarized him. You know, we can't just take things at the tail end and say this is evil, that we are so good and they are so evil. I mean, how did the evil get there in the first place?
First of all, this is my personal point of view, that war is never a solution. It has never been a solution during the history. From, let's say, simply if we can see the First World War and the Second, and I don't know, later on, any kind of war is not a solution. Whenever you talk about the war, you have to understand there is civilian or innocent casualties. So who is responsible for that? And what about the people who have been just simply killed by bombs? Mistake or no mistake doesn't make a sense.
Can you tell us some of the experiences of living through the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan?
So every day I was getting these newses about the injured people, about the casualties, about women, about children especially, who were deaf because of the sounds of bomb, about the woman who lost their children. They were pregnant and they lost their children because of the fear they had from the sound of bombs. These all were really terrible. And I was there to just inform the colleagues, my colleagues and our supporters in other countries. And I was sending emails talking about the life of these people. And we even organized some food distributions, blanket distributions, and sponsoring some families from the war situation.
would you respond to especially government officials in this country who say, of course we should go into Iraq because look at what we did in Afghanistan. We got rid of the Taliban for the people there. We can do the same with Saddam Hussein. How do you respond to that being inside the Afghan government currently?
No, I personally I'm not happy, and I never been happy from very beginning when it was start last year, October, that bombing is not bringing peace. So, and I was giving the example of Iraq, that the Iraq was bombed for 11 years, but Saddam is still healthy and sitting over there and controlling the people. I don't think this is a good policy. The better policy would be to support the right people who believes on democracy in a country in order to change and to give the people the right to vote and let the people decide about their regime.
I just want to address the issue of bombing and civilian casualties. I've been working since December on the issue. I had family that was killed in Afghanistan as a result of the U.S. bombing. I've been working with Global Exchange and 9/11 families who had their own relatives killed on 9/11 who went to Afghanistan and saw what was going on there. In many cases, the United States government denies specific incidents. They say that, yes, innocent people have been killed in general. This is collateral damage. They refuse to admit to specific incidents. They refuse to acknowledge any particular deaths, and they refuse to help the people that they've killed.
So when did you come back to Afghanistan from Islamabad?
I was like just dreaming and waiting for any possible chance to come back, and it was right at the beginning of January 2002.
So you returned to a very different Afghanistan, I imagine, and at the time you returned, the U.S. was engaged in a bombing campaign of your country. What was that like?
It was very much terrible, and we could see like different signs of bombing different side of the city. I would strongly insist on the potential and the moral of Afghan people who brought this change in the country. Because if the support and if the willingness of Afghan community was not there, just bombing or military campaign or things would not help Afghan community. And it shows clearly that, especially the women, how they managed to do everything, how they managed to struggle at their homes to by educating their children, by educating the neighbors' children, by having like consultation and discussion at the street level, even very secretly. Even most of them was just checked by the Taliban, and they were charged to be in the jail, to be in the prisons, but they never gave up, and they never being tired or scared of doing such a struggle. It was the ground which was prepared on that time by men and women in Afghanistan.
But also, I think it's really important that we look at what has happened for Afghan women since the bombing. And I think all signs show, except for Kabul, that women are not liberated because of the bombing. And I think it's really important to point out that that bombing killed innocent Afghan people. And those people were real people. They had dreams and desires and lives and children, and they were children. And that's not getting out in the media. It's never, somehow those lives didn't matter, but the lives in the World Trade Center did matter. And those lives matter just as much. And bombings kill people. That's real.
Some of the speakers in that piece included Seema Samar, the former Minister for Women's Affairs, now leading the Human Rights Commission in Kabul, or Zala Ashraf, a young woman who founded a women's human rights organization in Afghanistan, among many others. Well, as the Bush administration pushes ahead with its agenda to attack the Iraqi people, as Saddam Hussein fails to comply with terms set forth through UN weapons inspections, some Americans are promising to withhold their federal taxes if we go to war. Mary Lehrer with the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee says 167 opponents of U.S. military action in Iraq will refuse to pay their federal taxes.
As conscientious objectors to war, we commit ourselves to refuse to pay some or all of the federal taxes that fund the military attacks on Iraq. Over the past 11 years, individual conscientious objectors have gone to jail for protesting the Gulf War, gone to Iraq in violation of a U.S. travel ban, carried humanitarian supplies into Iraq in violation of the sanctions, and watched with immense sadness as hundreds of thousands of Iraqi citizens died because U.S. bombs destroyed their civilian infrastructure, and U.S.-initiated sanctions resulted in starvation and disease. We call on all those who oppose the military attacks on Iraq to join us in refusing to pay for it, and instead to redirect their federal tax money to heal the wounds of war. We ask people of conscience to refuse to pay the federal excise tax on their phone bills and or to refuse to pay some or all their federal income taxes as a clear signal to our government that continuing the cycle of violence is wrong.
Okay. You're calling on Americans to refuse to pay their taxes. Isn't that illegal? And what are the consequences to this form of protest? Are war tax resistors prepared to do jail time for their stance?
Yes, it is illegal in most situations, although there are some ways in which it is legal, such as living below the taxable income or taking legal deductions. But mostly what people in our group do is illegal, and people are prepared to take the consequences. But hardly anyone ever goes to jail. It's been about six people since the 1940s. So mostly what the IRS wants is to collect the money from people. So they may garnish people's wages or take it out of their bank accounts. But people that don't pay their federal taxes often turn around and give the money that they would owe to the IRS, and they give it to life-affirming groups that they believe in. So they often end up paying twice. But some people stay off the radar screen by not filing, but we are conscientious objectors. We're not tax evaders, so we're just doing this for reasons of conscience.
Now, are you refusing to pay all your taxes, or are there some percentage of the overall tax has been calculated to be for the military that you're refusing to pay? I heard you mention the federal excise tax.
Well, that's about the phone bills. On our phone bills, 3% is called federal excise tax, and that goes into the U.S. general budget, out of which that's their budget for everything. So close to 50% of that goes to war. So by the estimation of a group in New York City, the War Resisters League, this year it's 46% that goes to military, and that's past and present. So some people withhold the 50%, the 46%, and pay the other part, and then other people withhold the whole thing because they know that the government is not going to distinguish once they get that check.
No, they certainly aren't going to distinguish. In fact, you know, as well-meaning as this is, if you consider the impact this might have on the overall tax system, because the administration is not going to say, oh, we don't have enough money to attack Iraq, so let's hold off until we raise the money. They'll just take what they need, and perhaps other areas like education funding or health care or housing will suffer instead.
Well, people take the money that they owe to the IRS and they give it to groups like that. So it's not that we don't believe in taxes or want, you know, it is a difficult decision, but we're conscientious objectors. We wouldn't go to war, and we don't want to pay someone else to go to war in our place.
But it's still, in my opinion, a pretty daring way to express your political feelings about this, because Uncle Sam is pretty ferocious even on a good day. They don't take too kindly to people not paying their taxes,
No
matter how noble or justified. What prompted you to choose this tactic, this strategy?
Personally?
Yes.
Well, I went to college in the early 80s, and when it was the height of the arms race, and I don't believe in war. I don't believe that we need to be killing other people to solve our problems. And the arms race was at that time and still is, I think, insane that we have enough weapons already to bomb the whole world, and yet we keep building more. And I don't know any way other to say it, except to me it's insane. And that's taking away from resources that could be going, like you said, to healthcare, to education, to the arts, to housing. And so it's just a formula that doesn't make sense to me. And I think it's time that we learned how to solve our differences without using violence.
Mary Lair of the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, former Black Panther Bob Brown and Noam Chomsky weigh in against the war.